Hello, we're Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There's no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word. Or message us on Instagram at PacUnderground.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Act Now on Climate Emergency, Thursday, February 27th, 4 to 7 p.m. at Portland City Hall. This climate emergency rally will demand annual steps to reduce carbon emissions by at least 8% each year and to end Zenith tar sand oil exports. Enjoy street theater, music, and a puppet show. Again, Act on Climate Emergency this Thursday, 4 to 7 p.m., City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. More information can be found at kboo.fm's homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 11 a.m., and we're going to hear from Suzanne LeGrand, speaking about radical pleasurists and women claiming pleasure for ourselves. Let's listen in.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine. Today I'm talking with Sophie Traeger, teacher, coach, facilitator, and radical pleasurist. Welcome.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
So, radical pleasurist, what an idea. This is an idea that you created. Could you tell us what is a radical pleasurist?
Absolutely. I love playing with words. And the first words that came to me a few years ago was radical pleasure. And I've always been some kind of rebel, maverick, unconventional, non-mainstream stir of things. And so the word radical is just getting really trendy. And I'm always thinking about pleasure and joy and happiness and how to increase more of that in our lives. And so I just made up radical pleasurist as somebody who is devoted to experiencing radical pleasure in their life at every moment.
Why is pleasure important for us to experience? I mean, a lot of people would say, well, you know, we have a lot of problems in the world that we need to fight for or resist. Why focus on pleasure?
That's a really good question. I have noticed, and being an activist myself in many different ways, is I lived my life in a way that was filled with depression and anxiety and forcing, and that didn't feel good. It literally didn't feel good in my body, didn't feel good in my mind. And so I decided, what would it be like if I made choices in a different way, if I chose to view the world through a completely different lens. Yes, there's a lot going on out there. I don't deny that. I just offer to people and to myself different options on the menu. And also, I really like redefining or helping people remember what something means. And for most people, pleasure is very triggering. Intimacy is very triggering. People automatically think about sexual things. And I'm here to say that it's about pleasure, which to me is synonymous with joy and ease and peace. And I just feel better when I am making choices that's leading me to what feels good. And what's awesome, Suzanne, is that it ends up benefiting everybody else. It's kind of a crazy thing.
How did you come up with this notion of radical pleasure? Could you tell us a little bit about your journey? Because I don't think that's where you started, right?
No. Like I said, I lived pretty much, I would say, 38 years of my life. I just turned 41. looking through a very dark lens. I had very dark glasses on, so I would see the world and expect hatred. I would expect to be treated poorly. I expected to be taken advantage of. I lived with a lot of anxiety and paranoia. I always expected people to let me down. And with with great suffering, there comes a point where I dropped down on my knees and I said, I don't want to live this way anymore. And I had a long career as a psychotherapist. So I would hear about problems day in and day out. And what I noticed that helped people the most was when I asked them to tell a different story about themselves. The story that included how resilient they are, that included all the exceptions to the darkness that they were experiencing in their life. And so I started to look at myself the same way. Where in my life was their love? Where in my life was their joy? And guess what? When you focus on love and joy and pleasure, you start to see more of it and it starts to feel good. And so again, with radical pleasure, it's just playing with words. And I get nerdy about words because language and words shape our reality. So instead of hearing the story in my own head of how much I suck, and this is the story that everybody hears and believes and thinks is normal, I decided that I was going to tell myself a different story. And with radical pleasure, I literally looked up the definition of radical and pleasure and put them together to create, and this is on my website, to create the meaning of radical pleasure, which is a far-reaching and expansive experience and feeling of happiness and joy. Who doesn't want that?
Absolutely. The question, of course, is how you get there.
Yes, exactly.
In your work, you talk a lot about people-pleasing. And people-pleasing is kind of the opposite end of radical pleasure.
Yes.
Could you talk about why that is? And also just what you think of as people-pleasing?
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, our tagline is from pleaser to pleasure. Again, that, you know, play on words. When I looked at my life and I noticed why the same things kept happening, why I was in the same kinds of relationships, why I had so much fear, I noticed that I was people-pleasing, meaning I was doing whatever it took to get people to like me, because all my life, I wanted to feel that I belonged. I wanted community. And the way that I learned that was what I thought was to deny my own desires, my own needs, never rock the boat, don't ruffle feathers, things like that, like stay quiet, because I'm not a quiet person. But I was taught to stay quiet. And not to show emotions. That is how I and many, many people survive. We learn to be people pleasers because we form in our minds what we think others want of us. So we start to do that. We start to speak in a certain way. We start to act in a certain way that we think is going to get us love, that we think is going to get us connection, or whatever it is we want. And it has a very high cost.
What's the cost?
For me, it was the ironic thing. It was a deep sense of loneliness, because I completely forgot and didn't know what it was to be myself. I had no idea what I liked or needed or desired. And I was actually really afraid of people and did not experience true intimacy, deep connection with people, because either I was people pleasing or I was being an ice queen, which is putting up a wall where nobody can come through, and I wouldn't let myself out. So I felt extremely lonely, extremely depressed. That was the cost.
Now, men can be people pleasers as well as women, but it seems that there is a connection between the way in which women are raised and the tendency for women to be people pleasers. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how gender training for women tends to create people pleasers?
Absolutely. And I also, along with that, would like to make a point that my male clients experience the same exact thing. They also experience being people pleasers. It just might look differently, but the detriment is the same for both sexes. For women, the way that, well, what's really interesting is that I was raised actually to be pretty masculine, in the sense of suppressing my feelings, my creativity, my connection to my body, my intuition. And so I was raised in a way, in a culture, in a family where the greatest importance was placed on doing and achieving and accomplishing and being really educated, which means that, again, I suppressed my own creativity and desires to be a people pleaser. I was raised to be seen and not heard. I was raised to be very nice and polite, and to listen to people even when I didn't want to, or to take care of people even if I didn't want to. So I suppose that is what is expected of women, what I was taught to be expected of women. And I watched my mom, a very high executive engineer, professional woman, go between these worlds of highly male-dominated field, but also being at home, caretaking, cooking, cleaning, taking care of everyone. So there was, I mean, it felt really schizophrenic to me. There was all these mixed messages of be really independent and also be a good wife.
Some people use the term emotional labor. And I think Arlie Hochschild has talked about the second shift.
Oh, yeah.
That women are supposed to work a full day and then go home and do emotional labor, yes, house cleaning, etc., at home as well.
Yes. Yes, that is probably one of the, I believe, the more subtle ways that people are people pleasers, in the way that we're expected to listen and hold space for people and allow others to dump their emotional whatever baggage on us, and we don't have anything to say about it. For example, I've been told, and I've heard this by many people, that I'm not a good girlfriend, I'm not a good partner if I don't listen, if I don't soothe the other person. And I decided that's BS, and I'm not going to do that anymore unless, one, I'm asked if I'm available and have the capacity to listen, and two, I have a time limit. I have a limit to how much I can give to someone, and I want to be honored when I say, you know, I've reached my capacity to listen right now. I'm not here to do that for you. I'm here to love and to support, but it's not always going to happen. So there's a lot of nuances to communication. You were talking about the how before. One of the big hows is communication, effective communication.
And also it sounds like recognizing your limits and being willing to stand up for them in some ways.
100%. Absolutely. That is really everything that Radical Pleasurist does and teaches is, one, can you get to know again where you end and somebody else begins? So there's that work on boundaries. And even allowing yourself to have boundaries, allowing yourself to have desires and needs, and releasing that belief, oh, if I have needs, I'm needy. I mean, there's so much to this. So recognizing that you have boundaries, that you have a certain way that you want to live, and that it's okay. It's absolutely okay. And then speaking those boundaries out loud.
So a lot of the work you do is training people to communicate differently, but also to recognize and to perceive their own needs.
Yes, exactly. And for those that come to me and that I work with, it's the first time in their life that someone has said to them and given them permission to have needs and desires. So when I ask the question, what do you need? People are stumped. I help them and encourage them to think about their needs and to write them out exhaustively.
You mentioned three things that seem to me to be connected to pleasure and maybe to moving away from people-pleasing. You mentioned creativity, intuition, and embodiment.
Yes.
Could you talk about how those are connected to pleasure on one hand, and also it seems also to self-empowerment?
Yes. Okay, so you mentioned intuition, embodiment, and
creativity.
Creativity, yes. They are inextricably connected. It begins with embodiment. All the practices that we teach, we begin with the body.
Why is that?
Well, we're quite familiar with the experience of living in our heads, with the experience of using very skillfully our analytical brain, that part of us. What what we are not as well versed in and connected with is the part of our brain that tells us to focus on sensations in our body. That is very, very foreign for people. And my deep experience and the experience of everyone I talk to and work with is once they get into their bodies, and there's a lot to explain to that, but once you can get into your body where you're feeling your sensations and you're allowing emotions to come up to your awareness and you gain an expanded vocabulary for what you're feeling, then you can be connected to whatever creativity is moving through you. Because it's usually not, it doesn't usually start with a thought. It starts with an experience, a feeling in the body that becomes an inspired thought. So there's the creativity and the embodiment piece. And then the intuition is, to me, the same thing as creativity. It is connecting with something that nobody can really explain, but it's a very powerful decision maker and more accurate than I believe the analytical mind. I believe the analytical mind is what gains inspiration from our intuitive selves. And how it leads to pleasure. When we follow our intuition, when we receive inspired ideas or thoughts, that usually leads to a pleasurable experience. Not to say it's not hard, not to say there isn't a process, but it leads to our joy, our bliss, that experience of feeling passionate where time doesn't exist. That's the pleasure that comes from embodiment, creativity, and intuition.
You talk about varieties of pleasure. Part of being a radical pleasurist is not, you do talk about sexual pleasure, which is where everybody tends to go, mm-hmm. but you also talk about creating or making possible pleasure in all ways. Can you talk about what some of those other ways are?
Oh, yes. I love talking about this. It's more along the lines of different types of intimacies that people have no idea exist, that they don't know that these are options on the menu. This is huge. Knowing that there's different kinds of intimacies, that there's different ways of connecting and receiving and experiencing pleasure was a game changer for me. I went from being extremely lonely to feeling extremely fulfilled in my life, which is right now. And the different intimacies are, there's the sexual intimacy, which is what we usually think of when we think of as intimacy, is the sexual act or conversation or fantasy, and that's one part of it. Then there's physical intimacy, and that is one of my favorites. And most people will understand that through anyone who's familiar with the love languages, touch being one of the love languages. That's my primary, as well as words of affirmation. So physical intimacy is the experience of feeling connected through touch, platonic touch that is not sexual. That blows people's minds. They're like, I don't even know what you're talking about. How is that possible? Like, maybe with my kids, I get it, or with a massage therapist, or with my pets, but with a partner, a spouse, a friend, you know, nobody's cuddling anymore. Nobody's snuggling anymore. It's fraught. And so I'm saying that's on the menu, my friends. Get back into physical intimacy. And that has been extremely healing for me. It rewired my entire nervous system. There's emotional intimacy, which is sharing deep feelings with each other. Thank you, Brené Brown, for introducing us to the power of vulnerability. That's where emotional intimacy comes in. Then there's spiritual intimacy, sharing of our beliefs. So much, we're afraid to share what we really believe in. We're afraid to talk about God. We're afraid to talk about source. We're afraid to talk about what drives us. That's spiritual intimacy, meditating together, being in sangha, community together. And then there's intellectual intimacy. That one most people are familiar with. And yet it's still challenging for people to share vulnerably our ideas, our intellectual property with each other. So those are just five that I've been talking about teaching for years. There's so many financial intimacy. I mean, there's so many ways to connect vulnerably.
So you teach people how to be emotionally intelligent and intimate. That's part of the work that you do.
Yes.
Can you just describe a little bit more about how you get people to be emotionally intelligent, intimate, and also to be able to recognize these other forms of intimacy that you're talking about?
Well, number one is a willingness. I've talked to a lot of people who have said, I don't want to feel. And if you don't want to feel, then you're not going to be a radical pleasurist. You're cutting yourself off from a lot of options for pleasure in your life. So there's no way around this. You have to feel, and you have to feel everything, not just the so-called good feelings, but everything. So the way that we teach this, I'm also a certified yoga teacher. I'm into somatic experience. There's no way around being in the body. There just isn't.
How do you get in the body?
Well, we have this really amazing tool called the breath. And so I teach breath work. That's one tool that I use. I use yoga. I have a lot of methods, but the umbrella for all of this is, can you slow down and pause? That's number one, because we don't do that either. Can you slow down and pause for just a moment and experience what you're feeling in your body in the moment? That's it. Like, what do you feel in your chest? What do you feel in your throat? What do you feel in your fingers? That's it. That is already foreign to people, just to slow down. And what do you feel right now in this moment? And then we expand that.
Do you think that were people to experience more pleasure in their lives and also more intimacy, and you see a connection between experiencing pleasure and also connecting to other people, if people were able to do that, do you think that would create a larger change in society?
Yes. This is a paradigm shift. This is a completely different way of looking at yourself and others in the world. There's two different programs operating in our lives. There's the fear program and there's the love program. Fear is the anxiety, the depression and war and all that stuff. And the love is the pleasure and the joy and peace and ease, which everybody says they want, but they resist a lot because the fear program is very, very powerful. And it's a choice. So a lot of people say, oh yeah, I have a lot of pleasure in my life. Like, I have friends and I go out and I drink and I do this and I, you know, I have the cars and I have the house and I play the games and I do the things and I travel. I have a lot of pleasure in my life. Great. How are you feeling? How are you feeling in your life? Depressed? Okay. You feeling lonely? Okay. It's a choice. It's a moment-to-moment choice. And so in each moment, what do you want to choose? Do you want to choose to experience joy? No matter what's going on. And I'm not sugarcoating, like, you know, life is fluffy and peachy and awesome all the time. No matter what is going on, what are you going to choose? If you choose to see joy and pleasure and blessing in that moment, yeah, everything changes from then on. Everything, your relationships, the way you see people completely changes. The way you talk to people completely changes. And this is this is personal truth. Like, I know this. I've experienced this. I've witnessed people experiencing this.
And if more people were to do this, what would the world look like? I mean, do you have any sense?
And this is everything that we all dream of. What I see is we would stop and be curious about each other. We would stop and take a moment to look into each other's eyes and maybe ask more questions. We would always go back inward into our bodies and feel instead of try to make others make us feel anything, which is just not the case. Nobody makes us feel anything. We're all a reflection of each other. So if that's the case, why don't we just see love through each other? I mean, the possibilities are endless. Like, we would just we would just be enjoying life and the gorgeous world that this is, the gorgeous nature. Like, we're lucky we live in Portland. It's stunning here.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I have been talking today to Sophia Traeger, who is a radical pleasurist.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And if you all want to learn more, head over to radicalpleasurist.com.
Great. I am Suzanne LeGrand for Radio Zine on KBOO FM Portland.
Come join in the conversation with ML Laurie on our new podcast, What the Hell is Going On? A conversation about our human experience, our human condition, and the obstacles that we all have to happiness. This podcast is an extension of the segment Let's Stop for a Minute that ML produced for the KBOO radio show, The Politics of Living. So go to kboo.fm/whatthehellisgoingon, or you can go to www.kboo.fm. Audio, podcasts, and what the hell is going on.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Hi, I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine. Today I'm speaking with Catherine Rowland, who is a writer, researcher, and author of the just-published book, The Pleasure Gap: American Women and the Unpublished Sexual Revolution. To start, let's talk about the title of your book, The Pleasure Gap. Can you explain what the pleasure gap is that your book explores?
So the pleasure gap firstly describes the differences that research has continually surfaced between how men experience pleasure, sexuality, and desire, and how women experience it. And in broad strokes, it appears that women are just deriving far less satisfaction in their sexual lives than men. And we see this showing up not only in the orgasm gap, that's a much circulated term, essentially describing how women on average have one orgasm for every three that men experience, but it also refers more broadly to women's sense of safety, security, and entitlement in their sexual interactions, and overall just deriving less satisfaction than men. But I think importantly that the pleasure gap also looks at, if I can remember what my book is about. Sorry, Suzanne.
No problem.
But the pleasure gap also looks at major differences between how women respond physically to arousal and how they respond subjectively or emotionally to sexuality and desire. And what you see in studies and what women report is that when they're exposed to a range of sexual stimuli, they might become physically or genitally aroused, and yet they report being absolutely emotionally or psychologically numb to that sensation. So they're not actually deriving any pleasure or feeling any sexual excitement of any kind. And I was really, really interested in why that gap exists and what that gap signifies. So that's another piece of the pleasure gap. And lastly, and I think critically, the pleasure gap describes the difference between the sensuality and sexuality that we actually experience or that we long to experience, and then the states of excitement and arousal that the media continually bombards us with and sort of tells us that we should be experiencing. And women really hold themselves, women, I should say men too, really hold themselves hostage to these absurdist ideas of what sex should look like and sound like and feel like, and that leaves little room for what's actually playing out on their bodies.
So there's a lot of gaps between reality and what it is that people say or are told they're supposed to feel, women in particular, that is. I'm curious why there are these gaps between, for example, what women supposedly physiologically experience and what they recognize as desire, or what they would say themselves is desirable.
Yes. I think there's no one answer for why that's the case. I think there's a host of contributing factors. Amongst them are the fact that I think women just out of the gate from childhood onward are encouraged to censor and censure their own desires, labeled as risky, as dangerous, as something that's bound to get them in trouble. And yet at the same time, they're so frequently encouraged to engage in a performative sexuality. So I think the lesson from very early on is that your sex does not really belong to you. And I think over time, this becomes really deeply internalized to the point where it starts affecting how women are feeling in their bodies. Another arm of research here suggests that women, for whatever reason, and I confess I'm not entirely sure why this is, because no one has really determined a clear explanation here, but that women tend to sort of shut off sensation more frequently than men. That men tend to be more in sync with what's taking place within their body, be that escalating heart rate or shifts in blood pressure or the ravenous roar of hunger in their bellies. And this is a process called interoception. And research suggests that women have lower levels of interoception than men do, which sort of flies in the face of how theorists and scholars and medical practitioners have considered women's bodies throughout history. We've always kind of thought of women as mired in blood and swampy feeling and really just being completely and inextricably of their bodies. And yet what we see more and more is that women kind of shut off those feelings, and to the point where it's showing up with often even fatal consequences. I mean, women are experiencing early signs of heart disease and yet busily scrubbing the dishes or cleaning up the kitchen. So what's going on that women are silencing the cries of their own bodies and not listening to what's taking place? I think part of what that is indicating is just how encouraged, particularly in this modern moment, how encouraged women are to sort of be everything and be of service to others, and to not put themselves forward, to not feel entitled to being able to put themselves forward, to the point where they can't hear what's taking place in their bodies.
And what are the forces that are at work in women perhaps numbing their own feelings or not feeling entitled to express or have their own needs?
Again, I think there's a range of forces. I think part of it is the general social marginalization of women in certain continued arenas where there is a subtle but persistent message that women are not as entitled or as equal as men are socially. And so I think that leads to a certain quieting. One trend that I observed sort of first with a kind of benign interest and then with mounting alarm was women's propensity to fake it. That is to pretend pleasure where none in fact is being experienced. And I wondered you know, why is this happening? Why is this continuing to happen in this day and age where we really vaunt and value female pleasure and sort of we see female orgasm more visibly than we've ever seen it before. And yet women are entering, at times, entering intimate interactions and are acting in a way that's completely out of sync with what they're actually feeling. And I think that part of it is that, ironically, as female pleasure has become more visible and more expected, women have carried with them the message that they need to enact these sensations so as to appear healthy, liberal, game, feminine, what have you, when indeed that's not what they're actually experiencing. And I saw this to the point where women would sometimes report being in a state of physical pain, of being in a situation in which they felt potentially harmed or imperiled, and yet still, rather than say, get your hands off me and stop, they were pretending pleasure so as to usher this interaction along. And for me, that was so striking, and that it just so clearly indicates this idea that women are still not included in how we're viewing pleasure and how we're viewing successful and complete sexuality in certain circumstances.
You know, you raise a really thorny question here, which is that if women have suppressed their own needs and desires, or if they have been trained to please others first or primarily, then how can they consent?
I think that is the thorny question, because especially as we are revisiting on a very needed and big way, this question of consent and its fundamental importance. As I was thinking about this very issue in reporting for and writing the book, I was so struck by the complete erasure of the question of female desire in all discussions around consent. The way that consent tends to be framed is very anachronistic. It's a bargain between a power holder and someone with lesser power. And so how, if women aren't tuned in to what they do in fact desire, can they actually consent? I think for a more optimistic spin, that the fact that desire can be learned, that women are absolutely endowed with the ability to tap into what feels good and to follow sensation as it moves throughout their lives and changes over time and moves throughout their body, that as they become more intimately acquainted with the qualities of their desire and their pleasure, that they're then able to consent. But I think this sort of changing nature of consent also underscores the necessity of the changing nature of desire, rather, underscores the necessity of thinking about consent as something that we have to continually revisit across the lifespan. Too often we frame consent as merely an exchange that's happening amongst young people or single people. And for some women that I spoke to, particularly women who were partnered and more mature, part of their process of sexual rediscovery and erotic empowerment was actually drawing boundaries with their long-term partner and reintroducing consent as an erotic tool in their intimate relationships.
Your study focuses primarily on heterosexual women. Why?
That's a fantastic question. In part, the focus ended up landing as closely on heterosexual women as it did because as I spoke with queer women and waded through what there is of the literature on women who have sex with women or primarily have sex with women, it seemed that queer women were not beset with the same volume of distress around desire and pleasure and orgasm and self-knowledge. And I think that part of that has to do with the fact that women who have sex with women tend to have more intimate bodily knowledge. In sort of mechanical terms, sexual interactions tend to take place for far longer than the 3 to 13 minutes of penetrative intercourse that often characterizes heterosexual exchange. But moreover, it seemed to me that women who have sex with women who identify as queer have done some fundamental work around the nature of their own desire. Whereas for heterosexual women, it often was sort of a choiceless choice, something that they weren't thinking about, that just started defining their interactions. And then think in that population amongst heterosexual women, there's just this very narrow idea that sex culminates in penetrative activity, even though that so rarely on its own produces satisfaction for women. So in a way, queer women were left out of some of the broader arcs of the book because it struck me that they're faring far better on this front than the majority of straight women.
How did you go about doing this research? It seems to me that given some of the pressures that you talked about for women to want sex, to like sex, to consider all of their sex good, how is it that you got women to actually talk about what their experience was, or to examine whether or not what they felt was what they thought they should feel?
Mm-hmm. You know, I found that even for all the pressure and the many masks that are piled on top of female sexuality, that there is still a tremendous appetite to speak about this. And I think that that appetite is reflected in sort of the booming market for sexual services that we see right now. But I found that oftentimes I had to do little more than mention to someone down the block that I was working on this project than for my inbox to start filling up with people saying, I really want to talk about this, because what's not ever being discussed is how these things actually make me feel. Which is not to say that there weren't ample conversations where women said, I'm not going to go any further than this. And they weren't as deep in terms of exchange, but overwhelmingly, I found that women were eager and hungry and really ready to talk about this and sort of peel away the layers of myth and pathology and shame and misunderstanding that tends to shroud this subject.
What was it that women were eager to talk about that they hadn't been able to talk about?
A couple things there. I think one was devastatingly, though realistically not that surprising, was trauma. I found that so often I didn't set out to explicitly talk about instances of sexual violence or abuse, but that subject just persistently came up. It wasn't universal, but it was so common. And I was
just to
away.
Clarify, so you're saying that women are experiencing a lot more sexual trauma than is being talked about, or
I
that
would
it
say
hasn't
yes,
been
and
talked
even
about?
I think we're in the midst of a conversation around the extent and depth of sexual trauma, and I feel like that still doesn't entirely capture the scope of what's taking place in women's lives, both directly and indirectly. Just women's continual exposure to the threat of trauma and abuse, I think, in and of itself is traumatizing. But in terms of direct abuse, an overwhelming number of the women I had talked to referred to horrific or deeply unwanted past experiences. So I think that is something that women very actively want to discuss. Another piece is the sheer boredom that a lot of women experience and their coping mechanisms for managing that boredom in the context of also feeling like they need to, and I'm speaking of, when I reference boredom, I'm talking more about women who are in long-term monogamous partnerships, wherein there's this, I think, larger than ever pressure to foster romance and excitement through the years, if not the decades, and sort of balancing that very beautiful hope and expectation with what's often a plodding physical reality is stressful. And women really wanted to talk about that. But I also found that women were eager to sort of move past the discussion of kind of what you did and how you did a description of moves and maneuvers, if you will, and talk about what they were actually feeling, which is so often left out of common discussions. I think we're more comfortable than ever with referencing anatomy and kind of the crude mechanics of physical acts, but actually talking about what sensation that produces is like taboo and totally hush. So women wanted to discuss that as well.
You know, it's interesting. There's this longstanding sexist stereotype that women are less sexual than men and less interested in sex. And on the other hand, a lot of women today, especially young women, are expected to crave and openly pursue sex. What is the reality here between these two poles?
It's such an interesting moment of tension that we're seeing right now. I mean, I think the reality, as reality often is neither. I think in terms of this idea that women are inherently less sexual, less libidinous, less interested in sex, we can chalk that up to a laden historic construct that's changed a lot through time, depending on the social era in which we find ourselves. I think fascinatingly, if we look into deep history, there was a huge investment in women as being sexual, deeply sexual creatures. Women were sort of thought of as the inversion of men, and the successful continuance of the species rested on women's ability to orgasm like men, to sort of release their seed in orgasmic ejaculate. And we've certainly done away with those with those ideas over time. But I think we've been variously invested in different ideas around the strength of female sexuality over time. And I think just as that idea of the passionless, frigid, sexually disinterested woman is a product of history, I think the idea of the hyper-libidinous, I don't care who I do it with, I just love sex, idea that is trafficking in contemporary media is equally a construct. And I think the truth is, you know, on one obvious level, is that we're not going to ever talk about a singular nature of female sexuality, or certainly of human sexuality. It really varies from person to person and place to place. But that sexuality, as much as anything else, is a sort of negotiation of life and society around us. and is going to be contoured by what feels safe as much as what feels exciting and acceptable.
You know, a lot of people talk or are talking right now about the gender pay gap, the fact that women are paid less than men on the whole, and even for jobs where they're doing the same work. I'm wondering, is there a connection that you see between the pay gap at work and the orgasm gap in private life?
That's a great question. And I think they are related in the sense that the, maybe not directly the orgasm gap, but the pleasure gap, as I understand it, I really think of it as like the canary in the coal mine signaling that the world is still not as equal or fair as we purport it to be. And insofar as our social experiences affect how we feel physically and mentally in the world, I think the pay gap as being this continued assault to women's dignity, worth, and the quality of their labor certainly informs a drag down experience of what they are entitled to feel in terms of pleasure. But I think, I guess thinking beyond that, you could also see that pay gap as informing a broader sense of not just women's internalized sensation, but sort of the larger social remark on what women are worth and the apparent consensus in capital markets that women are worth less than men and they deserve less. And so you could certainly see that as being resonant in the realm of pleasure, as in the realm of take-home pay.
Mm-hmm. What do you think needs to change in our society in order for women's pleasure to actually be important to women and to men?
I think we need to see broad changes in sort of public safety to move from a climate of generalized threat and risk to one of collective healing around our bodies and sort of the tragedies that have befallen men and women's bodies and that have been so normalized in current life. I think that is hugely a part of it, to create conditions in which sexuality is, in terms of physical experience and actual desire, is not contoured by a sense of risk. And crucially, I think we have to change education. So much education completely avoids or stigmatizes the very concept of pleasure, but to introduce pleasure as a facet of health and indeed public health, I think is a very necessary part of how we change all of this going forward.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I have been talking today to Catherine Rowland, who is the author of The Pleasure Gap, American Women and the Unfinished Sexual Revolution. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine on KBOO Portland.
Hello, we are Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There is no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word. Or message us on Instagram at PAC_Underground.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series featuring Robin and Linda Williams. With a rich career spanning over four decades, the duo have made it their mission to perform the music they love, a blend of bluegrass, folk, old-time, and acoustic country. Robin and Linda sang Americana before it was cool. The show is Friday, March 13th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland, Oregon. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, KBOO, Portland.